So if a U.S. tech startup, decides to expand into a massive international market, like India, for example, the biggest threat to their survival usually isn't local competition.
Right, it's rarely the product itself.
Exactly. It's actually their own corporate structure. I mean, one wrong box checked on some international tax treaty or one misunderstanding of local compliance, and suddenly 20% of your global revenue just evaporates into withholding penalties.
Yeah, before it ever even crosses back over the border, it's brutal.
It is. And that brings us to our mission for today's deep dives. We are analyzing this really strategic guide from KNM India, authored by Chavi Gao. It's titled India Entity Setup, IP Protection and Royalty Strategy for U.S.
It's a fantastic resource because, it forces a complete shift in perspective for any professional looking at
Yeah,
this.
we're not just looking at surviving the basic red tape today. We are examining the highly professional strategic optimization of a corporate structure. Taking a business international for you listening feels like learning to play 3D chess, but today we basically have the cheat sheet.
We really do. And understanding that playbook is just, well, it's critical for anyone in the professional sphere right now. The Indian market has undergone this massive evolution over the last decade.
Oh, totally. It's not just a place for cheap back office tasks anymore.
Exactly. It's a primary consumer market now and a global innovation hub. But capturing value in that kind of sophisticated ecosystem, it requires playing by a very specific, formalized set of rules.
Right, rules that govern capital and intellectual property. Okay, let's unpack this. Because before a company can protect its ideas or, move its money around, it actually has to exist legally.
Right, you have to lay that structural foundation first.
Yeah, and the source outlines three main business structures for entering India. And to make sense of this, I like to think about it like picking a fleet vehicle for a new sales territory.
Oh, I like that analogy. Let's hear it.
Okay, so first you have the one-person company, the OPC. In our fleet analogy, this is basically a solo motorcycle. It's fully contained, great for a single owner just navigating traffic, but it fundamentally lacks the capacity to carry heavy cargo or, bring passengers along.
Which completely eliminates it as an option for a U.S. startup planning on any aggressive growth, right? You can't take venture capital on a motorcycle.
Exactly. So the second option, the guy details, is the limited liability partnership, or LLP. Continuing the analogy, the LLP is kind of like a flexible delivery van.
Lots of room to move things around.
Right. It offers great flexibility, fewer administrative burdens for the partners. It works incredibly well for professional services or consulting groups, but it becomes a structural bottleneck if you want to plug in institutional venture capital.
Yeah, because VCs, they require clear, easily transferable equity tiers, Strict corporate governance. The van just doesn't have the armored security they want.
Which leaves us with the enterprise-grade option, the private limited company. This is the armored SUV, and this is the structure the guide strongly recommends for U.S. startups, right?
Absolutely. It acts as a hard firewall. It creates a strict, separate legal entity, meaning, if the Indian subsidiary faces a massive lawsuit or some catastrophic data breach,
The legal and financial liability is contained. The U.S. parent company and its investors are totally shielded.
right, and that firewall is precisely what makes the private limited structure non-negotiable for institutional investors. They need absolute certainty that their capital isn't exposed to unchecked international liability.
Yeah, they don't want a lawsuit in Bangalore taking down the headquarters in Austin.
Exactly. Furthermore, the private limited framework, it provides those standardized cap tables and board structures that global venture capital just, well, expects by default.
But picking the armored SUV is only step one. You still have to get it registered and out on the road, and the guide details this modern digital registration process.
Which is where we get into the acronyms.
Oh yeah, a lot of them. It talks about obtaining a digital signature certificate, a DSC, and a director identification number, a DN. And honestly, it sounds like standard bureaucratic friction. But then the source introduces this unified portal from the Ministry of Corporate Affairs called SPICE Plus. That's SPICE Plus.
Which is a massive deal for foreign founders.
Right. So why is this unified form such a game changer? Because for a U.S. professional, the incorporation process is usually incredibly fragmented.
Oh, it is deeply fragmented in the U.S. I mean,
Yeah.
think about it. A founder might incorporate in Delaware to satisfy their investors,
Yeah, pretty standard.
but then they have to register as a foreign entity to actually operate their office in California. Then they apply separately to the IRS for an employer identification
And
number.
they deal with all the state-level tax boards on top of that.
Exactly. It is a multi-step, multi-agency pipeline that can take weeks and a lot of lawyer hours.
So how does this spice plus form actually change that mechanism in India?
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, S-Spice Plus is a deployment of highly advanced digital public infrastructure. It basically consolidates multiple government agencies into a single concurrent digital application.
Wait, all in one form?
Yes. Through one single form, a U.S. professional secures the company name approval, the actual incorporation, the permanent account number, the PAN, which is your corporate identity for income tax,
oh, wow,
and the tax deduction and collection account number, the TAN, which allows the company to withhold taxes from local employees.
So it literally compresses weeks of distinct agency interactions into a single touch point. That is wild.
It fundamentally alters the entry experience. It sets a really welcoming tone. However, the system's efficiency demands absolute precision on the input side.
Right. Garbage in, garbage out.
Exactly. The source heavily emphasizes the critical nature of the Memorandum of Association, the MOA, and the Articles of Association, the AOA.
Right. And these aren't just boilerplate forms you can download off the internet.
No, not at all. The MOA acts as the outward-facing charter. It explicitly defines what the subsidiary is legally permitted to do in India. And the AOA is basically the internal source code,
dictating exactly how directors vote, how shares are transferred, all that power distribution.
Yes. And if those documents aren't drafted to align perfectly with the U.S. parents' bylaws, that digital efficiency we just talked about, it just accelerates you into a massive structural conflict.
Ouch. Yeah, that makes sense. So, okay, the foundation is laid. The company legally exists. The very next vulnerability highlighted in the guide isn't operational, it's intellectual.
Right, protecting the ideas.
Exactly. Shielding the company's most valuable assets.
Yeah.
Its patents, trademarks, and designs. And the source discusses this scheme for facilitating startups' intellectual property protection, known as the SIPP.
The SIPP scheme is fascinating.
It is, but there is a specific metric here that genuinely made me do a double take. It states that recognized startups receive an 80% rebate on patent filings.
Yep, 80%.
Now, I have to push back here. An 80% discount on government fees, that sounds like a marketing gimmick.
Oh.
I mean, does a rebate on a filing fee actually move the needle for a well-funded U.S. startup calculating their initial burn rate?
It's a totally fair question, but what's fascinating here is that this is a highly calculated macroeconomic lever. It's not a gimmick at all.
Okay, how so?
To understand why it moves the needle, you have to look at the traditional mechanics of intellectual property. Filing and defending patents across multiple international jurisdictions is notoriously expensive.
Oh, yeah. Lawyers, translations, filing fees in every single country.
Right. It can drain hundreds of thousands of dollars from a seed stage startup's runway before they ever even launch a product.
Yeah.
Consequently, the default U.S. strategy has historically been to keep all core IP tightly locked in U.S. holding companies.
So the strategy was essentially the brain stays in Silicon Valley and the hands are overseas just doing the operational execution.
Exactly. Keep the valuable stuff safe at home. But the Indian government recognized that to transition from just an outsourcing destination to a true global innovation hub, they had to incentivize the brain to move as well.
I see. So the 80% rebate lowers the barrier to entry.
Massively. By slashing the cost of patent protection specifically for startups, they drastically alter the financial modeling of global IP strategy. It suddenly becomes highly capital efficient for a U.S. founder to register and develop core IP directly within the Indian ecosystem.
It forces professionals to rethink their default legal structures. Like, why wouldn't you actively partner with local IP attorneys to secure those rights early and leverage the subsidy to extend your runway?
Exactly. It's just smart business.
But protecting that IP locally creates a new structural tension, though. Because if the intellectual property is actively generating revenue within the Indian market, that capital is sitting in an Indian bank account.
Yes, it is.
And the U.S. parent company and its investors ultimately need access to that capital. So how do you move it across borders without triggering a massive tax event in both countries?
Ah, yes. This is the absolute crux of multinational financial plumbing. The capital generally flows back to the U.S. primarily through royalty payments.
Right. Royalties are essentially licensing fees paid for the use of intangible assets. And here's where it gets really interesting.
Yeah, the structural stuff.
The source details the strategy of a tax-efficient dual holding structure. To visualize this, let's look at a landlord-tenant relationship or a master franchise model.
Oh, the franchise model works perfectly for this.
Right. The U.S. parent company holds the master franchise rights, so the core underlying IP, the brand, the blueprints. The newly formed Indian subsidiary operates as a localized node, like the tenant.
Uh-huh.
And that local node uses the IP to generate revenue in India. In exchange, they pay rent, basically a licensing fee or royalty, back to the U.S. master entity.
That structural division is standard practice. It's very smart. But the friction occurs right at the border.
Because the governments want their cut.
Exactly. When the Indian subsidiary attempts to transfer that royalty payment to the U.S., the Indian government naturally requires a percentage of that capital to be withheld as tax before it leaves the country.
Right, a withholding tax.
Yes. And without any intervention, the U.S. government would then tax that exact same revenue when it finally arrives in America, resulting in double taxation that completely destroys the profit margin of the entire expansion.
Nobody wants to pay taxes twice on the same dollar. So the intervention the guy focuses on is the DTAA, the avoidance of double taxation agreement between the U.S. and India.
A very, very important document.
Basically, a highly specific, legally binding treaty that prevents both jurisdictions from indiscriminately taxing the same stream of capital. But how does that actually play out in the accounting?
Well, the mechanism of the DTAA relies heavily on tax credits. So if the treaty stipulates, say, a 10% withholding rate on royalties in India,
the Indian subsidiary keeps 10% of the payment and remits it to the Indian tax authority.
Right. And then, when the remaining 90% arrives in the U.S., the IRS essentially grants the parent company a credit for the 10% already paid in India, which offsets their U.S. tax liability.
So when it's executed perfectly, it is basically net neutral to the company's global tax burden.
Exactly. It's elegant.
But, and there's a big but in the guide here, it heavily emphasizes utilizing local tax professionals to manage this. Why can't a U.S. CFO simply look up the 10% treaty rate online and just apply it?
Because international tax law is highly interpretive. It is not a DIY project. The definition of what constitutes a royalty under Indian domestic tax law often conflicts with the exact definition outlined in the DTAA treaty itself.
Oh, wow. So you could think you're paying a royalty, but the government disagrees.
Exactly. If a U.S. company categorizes, say, a software licensing fee incorrectly, the Indian tax authority might apply their domestic withholding rate, which could be 20% or even higher, instead of that favorable 10% treaty rate.
And then if the IRS disagrees with that categorization on the back end, they might refuse to grant the tax credit for the higher amount.
Leading to a true, unrecoverable loss of gross revenue. You aren't just paying more tax, you are actively bleeding capital due to poor structural engineering.
So engaging local tax professionals isn't just about outsourcing the data entry.
Not at all. It's about having legal experts who can align your commercial contracts with the specific interpretive nuances of both the DTAA and domestic law. It ensures that capital flows with minimal friction.
Okay, so we have the Unified Spice Plus Foundation build. We have the heavily subsidized IP protection locked in.
Right.
And we have the DTAA optimized royalty pipeline flowing.
The macro structure is incredibly sound at this point.
It is. So the final section of the guide shifts to the operational reality on the ground. What kind of ongoing day-to-day regulatory support does the Indian government provide to keep this highly engineered structure actually thriving?
This is where we get into the Startup India initiative.
Right, and specifically the critical importance of obtaining DPIIT recognition. That's the Department for Promotion of Industry and Internal Trade.
Yeah, DPIIT recognition is basically the operational catalyst here. Without it, you are treated as just a standard corporate entity subject to all the traditional regulatory friction.
But with it.
With it, the government fundamentally alters how they interact with your business. They basically roll out the red carpet.
Yeah, the guide lists several really intense compliance and financial perks. For instance, DPIIT recognized startups are permitted to self-certify their compliance with 6 different labor laws and 3 environmental laws.
Which is huge.
For a U.S. professional accustomed to the constant fear of preemptive foreign regulatory audits, self-certification is a massive operational relief. It shifts the regulatory burden entirely.
It really does. It moves the whole ecosystem from a culture of preemptive scrutiny to a culture of trust. I mean, think about it. A startup's primary directive in its first 3 years is just finding product market fit, right?
It's surviving.
Right. So by allowing self-certification, the government ensures that founders and local executives are spending their time actually iterating on their product rather than constantly preparing paperwork for routine, low-risk government inspections.
That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
And then there are the direct financial interventions. The source outlines tax exemptions for 3 consecutive financial years under Section 80 IAC. It details access to the fund of funds and the seed fund scheme.
All great perks.
But the one that really stands out from a structural perspective is the abolition of the angel tax. Let's break down the mechanics of that, because honestly, the name itself is slightly misleading. It sounds like a tax on good deeds.
Yeah, it does sound like that, but it was actually originally introduced as an anti-money laundering measure.
Oh, right.
Yeah. The mechanism worked like this. If a privately held startup received investment capital at a valuation that the tax authorities deemed higher than its quote unquote fair market value, the government would tax that excess capital as standard income.
Wait, but venture capital valuations are inherently based on future potential, not current book value. A seed stage tech company with zero revenue might legitimately raise millions based entirely on their IP and their market projection.
Exactly, which meant the angel tax was fundamentally incompatible with the reality of startup economics.
It essentially penalized companies for successfully raising early stage capital. It treated their high valuations as suspicious rather than, successful.
Right, so abolishing the angel tax for recognized startups removes a massive structural bottleneck that previously choked the flow of institutional seed funding into the country.
So what does this all mean? When we look at these perks together, the tax holidays, the self-certification, the removal of the angel tax, they all clearly accelerate growth. But there is one specific operational perk listed in the guide that I really have to challenge. It highlights a 90-day fast-track winding-up process for insolvency, basically a quick death. Why is a streamlined path to bankruptcy advertised as a premier benefit? Isn't advertising your failure mechanism a totally counterintuitive way to invite top-tier professionals to build in your market?
It sounds totally backwards, I know, but this raises an important question about how sophisticated capital actually views risk.
Okay, tell me.
You have to analyze this purely through the lens of venture economics. Professional investors, they operate on a portfolio model. They know statistically that a significant majority of early-stage startups will fail.
Right. Failure isn't a surprise, it is priced into the model.
Exactly.
What destroys the model then?
Trapped capital and trapped talent. In a traditional, heavily bureaucratic system, shutting down a failed company can take years of court appearances, lingering creditor disputes, and administrative stagnation.
So the company dies, but the legal entity becomes this zombie.
Yes, a zombie company. Meaning the founders are legally tethered to the corpse of the business, and any remaining capital is locked in escrow or drained by ongoing legal fees.
Ah, I see. So by guaranteeing a highly predictable 90-day fast track to legally dissolve a recognized startup, the Indian government is implementing a massive de-risking mechanism for venture capital.
Precisely. They are assuring institutional investors that if a venture fails, the postmortem won't become a decade-long liability.
It allows the remaining capital, and more importantly, those highly skilled founders, to be quickly released and redeployed into their next venture.
Exactly. By making it incredibly efficient to shut a company down, you actually drastically increase an investor's willingness to write the initial check to start one.
Wow, that completely reframes the entire concept. It isn't planning for failure. It's aggressively minimizing the friction of failure so that the market can take bigger, faster swings at innovation.
It is the absolute hallmark of a highly mature, structurally optimized business ecosystem.
Well, when we pull all of these elements together, synthesizing the strategic insights from Chavigara's guide at K&M India, a very clear picture emerges. Expanding a U.S. tech company or professional service into India is unequivocally an exercise in advanced structural engineering.
Yeah, it's not just hiring a few local reps. Every decision, from the initial corporate vehicle to the ongoing tax strategy, requires a deep understanding of interconnected legal and financial frameworks.
You utilize the Digital Spice Plus portal to deploy your private limited firewall. You leverage SIPP rebates to lock down your core intellectual property efficiently. You architect a dual holding structure and utilize the DTAA tax credits to ensure capital flows back to the U.S. without massive leakage.
Right. And you secure that DPIIT recognition to self-certify compliance and operate in a de-risked, highly fluid venture environment.
Navigating that level of technical complexity across two sovereign nations absolutely requires local professional advisors.
Totally. A U.S. founder just cannot rely on generalized knowledge here. Securing specialized local legal and tax counsel is the most critical investment a company makes during the expansion phase. It is the only way to ensure the structural plumbing holds up under the pressure of global scale.
So for you listening, whether you are a founder architecting your global expansion, an institutional investor evaluating the cross-border risk profile of your portfolio, or just a professional analyzing the mechanics of international trade, understanding these specific structural levers completely changes how you evaluate global market entry.
It really highlights that modern international business is, well, it's less about geographic borders and more about optimizing the regulatory and financial interfaces between different economic operating systems.
Which leaves me with a final thought for you to mull over. We began by looking at a U.S. startup expanding overseas. But if a company's intellectual property is heavily subsidized and registered in India, and its corporate architecture is optimized to fluidly cross borders via digital portals, and its capital flows are heavily defined by complex dual-holding international tax treaties, well, as you analyze the structural engineering of modern business, what actually defines a company's home country anymore?